Hey, everybody, this is Andy Marquette. I am joined by my colleague, Liz McTague. We are Liz Geek Out, the podcast where we talk about all kinds of things like movies, TV, film, books, comics, web comics, and anything that makes our little fangirl hearts go pitter-patter. Hi, Liz. How are you?
I'm awesome, Andy. How are you?
Well, you know, just loving all these movies and things that we get to look at all the time. Oh my God, who knew that fangirling could be so much fun?
Well, and of course, this is our 50th episode, so that's pretty freaking cool.
I know, right? Y'all, it's the big 50 episode, and we decided finally to do, Liz, I don't know, this is one of my favorite films. Can we honestly say that it's one of your favorites too?
Oh, definitely.
Okay. So this is one of our favorite films, y'all. It is Fury Road, part of the Mad Max series, but kind of not, because it's a whole different world. And that we just both love this film. Liz just rewatched it for probably the 17,000th time last night. I just rewatched it for the 17,000th time today. And I was just telling Liz, I said, every time I see this movie, there's something else that I pick up in it, and you know, in a scene or between characters, just there's just so much. It's so visual and it's so epic that you just kind of like, you get caught up in the action the first couple times you see it, and then you kind of go back and you start looking for, you know, the nuances between the characters and the inner relationships and how they develop. I just, every time I see it, I'm like, oh my God, I what, how did that happen? So anyway, let's get into this, friends. Mad Max Fury Road was released in 2015. It was a film that had been languishing in development since, are you ready for this, y'all? 1997. it got screwed up for, you know, whatever reasons, all kinds of various things happened, and finally it dropped in theaters in 2015. It follows, you know, if some of you are familiar with the Mad Max series, it's an apocalyptic, you know, the world is now an apocalyptic wasteland, and everybody drives around in these crazy vehicles, you know, scavenging for parts and for fuel and whatever else to help them survive. It's like basically a damn free-for-all out there. And certain people are able to form some sort of temporary alliances to survive. But overall, it's a free-for-all. This situation features a tyrant who controls some water. Water's a huge thing. They're out in the wasteland. And he controls water. And he's also a serious douche. But he also controls people. So we're dealing with sort of human trafficking in terms of women. But we'll come back to that in a minute. And one of his lieutenants, played by Charlize Theron, Imperator Furiosa, is sent on a mission to go get some more gas from a refinery called Gastown. So off she goes. But dun, 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 there's a plot afoot. She has actually kidnapped five of the women from his harem, and they are going off to make their way in the world to a place called the Green Place to find, you know, to be independent and to live their lives as they see fit. Well, Joe finds out about this, Immortan Joe, the tyrant, and what ensues is a massive car chase, action sequence, plot developments with more action, and it's just a visually stunning film, and I'm raving. Go, Liz, tell us more.
Well, the really nice thing about the film, one of many really nice things about the film, is that you don't have to have seen the other Mad Maxes to really just jump right in. I have not seen the other Mad Max films for a bunch of different reasons that I'm not going to get into. The most recent of which is that Mel Gibson is an ass and I no longer want to watch anything with him in it. But this, thankfully, does not have Mel Gibson. And yeah, I mean, it is set up perfectly so that you can watch it if you've got the backstory. You can watch it if you don't. It's going to be a fantastic story either way.
True. Max in Fury Road is played by Tom Hardy. Let's talk about themes of this movie. When this movie was, you know, it was being, there were trailers circulating and there were people, you know, there was buzz. people were talking about it, and everybody was like, oh, it's just another damn shoot 'em up apocalyptic, you know, Mad Max movie. And which is fine by me, because I saw the other Mad Max movies and I love post-apocalyptic movies. So I would have seen it regardless. But once you started like digging past the buzz, there were some things that started coming out, including the fact that this is actually a surprisingly and deeply feminist film. So let's talk about why that might be, Lise.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, and I was telling you earlier, the only reason I went and saw this movie in the theaters is because a bunch of men's rights activists were like throwing little hissy fits about it all over the place because it wasn't all about them. And I'd had no desire to go see it. And then they were getting all mad and I was like, huh, maybe there's more to this. And yeah, I went and saw it in the theaters and it was so good. I actually saw this one twice in the theaters. It was same. That good. I hardly ever do that, but damn.
Same. The point, you know, the movie's called Mad Max Fury Road, but Max is not the center of this story. And that's what makes it so interesting. He is not the main character. It's not really about him. The focus of this story is Imperator Furiosa, Charlize Theron, and the five women who accompany her to go to this mystical place called the Green Place, which Charlize, her character Furiosa, is from this place. She was taken from it and ended up serving at the Citadel with Imperator Joe. And all this time she's been like biding her time all these years to get back to this place. And she takes the opportunity to take these five women with her to go back to the place of the mothers. So there's this theme throughout, Lise, of mothers and what that means to various people. You see at the beginning of the film, sort of toward the beginning, when Imperator Joe is in, I can't think of any other way to describe this, but the milking room.
Yep.
And it's a brief scene, but he's in the room and he hands a bottle of white liquid to his big dumb son, and one of his big dumb sons, and it looks like milk. And then you see behind him all of these kind of heavy set women literally plugged into milking machines. And that's what that you're just like, what the actual fuck? I mean, these women are basically, he's got women used as wet nurses and then he's got women used as breeding stock. The breeding stock is what Furiosa took with her, one of whom is very visually pregnant. And then we find out later that another one is probably pregnant. So we've got this theme of motherhood throughout and the symbols of motherhood and what it means. You know, Furiosa was always talking about, you know, she's going back to the green place to the mothers.
Yeah. The other another thing I think is really telling is that, you know, we were just talking that Tom Hardy's Mad Max is not the main character. He's more of an observational character, right? I mean, he's the one through whose eyes we are watching the action unfold. But it's not about him. And there sure as hell are not a whole lot of action movies where, you know, it's not about the dude. Yeah. And this one just isn't. I mean, yeah, he's there. Yes, he's doing stuff. But for the vast majority of the movie, he is there sort of serving to help Furiosa's interest. He is not there serving his own interest.
Let's talk about the relationship between Max and Furiosa. Max ends up at the Citadel. You know, he's got serious mental baggage from his past. You know, he keeps having these visions of the people he couldn't save, including kids, and it's really fucked him up. He's a train wreck. And he is captured by the Immortan Joe's war boys. And these are Immortan Joe's soldiers who are basically, and I'm not sure about this, Lise, but they're basically either they're painted white or they're just deathly white all the time because they're dying from radiation poisoning. I just don't know what the deal is there. But his war boys, he find Max and drag him into the Citadel. And it turns out Max is a universal blood donor, which means he's very useful to the war boys because the war boys, you know, are dying all the time from radiation poisoning, and blood from donors helps them live a little bit longer and do the bidding of Immortan Joe. So Max is brought into this situation. That's how he ends up there.
Right.
Furiosa, meanwhile, escapes while Max is still in the Citadel. Immortan Joe finds out, sends the crews out, and the young war boy, Nux, N-U-X, who is on his, it's called half-life, meaning he's pretty much done for, wants to go out with a bang, literally. So he grabs Max as the universal donor, hooks him up to the front of his vehicle, and runs an IV, a bloodline, from Max to him so that he can go out and show Immortan Joe, you know, I'm serving you. Look at how great this is. And I will get Furiosa for you and sacrifice myself for you. That's how Max eventually ends up with Furiosa's party, because there's a huge car wreck. He survives. Nux survives. They're chained together. He drags Nux with him to Furiosa's vehicle. And now we have the setup for Max and Furiosa. The first meeting didn't go off very well.
No, it didn't. I mean, and yeah, there's this whole like big fist fight scene, which is just, it is hilarious because Nux is completely out cold. And Mad Max, you know, Max has to like carry him up, and then, you know, shit goes down. And he and Furiosa are like rolling around in the sand, and Nux is still attached to him. And so he's being like dragged this way and that way. And then at one point, Max is getting like, he's getting the upper hand on Furiosa. And so the other women like grab Nux and the chain and just haul him off. And for most of that fight, Nux is out completely cold.
It was such a, you know, here's Max. He needs Furiosa's vehicle, the war rig. And if you see the vehicles in this movie, they're literally different kinds of vehicles cobbled together into like this crazy mix of post-apocalyptic, almost steampunkish, cyberpunk sort of, you know, combinations. And he needs a vehicle to get the hell out. So yeah. His purpose is to steal Furiosa's vehicle, which mm-hmm. he tries to do. But Furiosa being Furiosa has, you know, a kill switch in there that only she can disable. She knows the code. So he doesn't get very far.
He gets like 50 feet away and then the truck dies. And he's like, ah, shit.
Which means that these two people have to sort of throw their lots in together, even though they are adversaries at first. You know, they both need the war rig to get to what they need to do. Max needs to be gone. Furiosa needs to be gone. So they come to sort of an uneasy truce.
Mm-hmm. An understanding.
Right. There's still a lot of like difficult, you know, scenes in here. And Max is still like waving his gun around because, you know, he can't trust anybody in the apocalypse. But from that initial meeting, then we watch, and it's only like a few minutes later where Max, I think, realizes he probably should help Furiosa because she has the vehicle. And if I'm left out here in the wastelands, I'm going to die.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a vehicle. There's all these crazy people from various tribes or whatever groups flying around on their vehicles. This is my ticket. It's my ticket out of here. And somewhere through this movie, we come into another kind of the theme. You brought it up, Lise. It was the, what was the theme that you brought up?
Sort of that learned selflessness?
Yeah, that one. Talk about that.
Yeah, so when Max and Furiosa first hook up, I think you said that, you know, he's interested in her because she has a quality that he hasn't seen very often in the wasteland, which is sort of this altruism. And what, you know, when he finds out that she's taking these women, not for her own personal gain, you know, in fact, you know, taking the women, it would be one thing for her to like bugger off and head to the green place herself. That she could probably manage fairly easily. To do it with like five of Immortan Joe's like most prized, for lack of a better term, possessions. You know, I mean, that is just ballsy as fuck, you know, and makes her life a whole lot more difficult, but she's still doing it. And so he has his interest piqued. And we sort of watch that arc go throughout the film as these people start to take care of and care for each other, to the point where by the end you have Nux, who's the war boy, who is like Immortan Joe's biggest freaking fan, has thrown, you know, he throws in with them and is willing to do whatever he can in order to make sure that they survive.
So, yeah, we watched it happen with Nux, and we saw it, you know, I think by the time they get to that the point of the movie where they're far enough away from Immortan Joe, and they're, like, to the green place, where ostensibly it's supposed to be, and we see that Max actually has maybe started to care about Furiosa. And I want to make it clear, friends, that this is not, like, a heterosexual love fest, okay? That's not the kind of relationship that Max and Furiosa have. They have sort of, it's deeper than that. It's like this weird connection because they recognize in each other something that they've gone through, that they've lost, whatever it is. I mean, if you think about it, the theme of home is also playing throughout this movie. Max lost his. He lost that. Furiosa was taken from her home. And then we find out later that it, you know, that's kind of lost too. And there's that scene as they're going back toward the Citadel, and Furiosa says, "Take me home," you know. Mm-hmm. So there's this theme of home, a sense of belonging. Where is that? What is that? And all of these disparate people who have never really they've had a place where they've been, but not a place that felt safe and secure as home. And maybe for the first time in Furiosa's life, the Citadel, which has been literally a prison for her all these years, is actually going to become a home because of the showdown in which everything went to hell for Immortan Joe. So I think that's an important theme too. And maybe Max realizes that, and of course he's not ever going to be the kind of guy who like settles down to start farming. That's just not his makeup.
No.
He's running from his ghosts. That's what he's doing. But for this brief moment, he was able to do for somebody something that helped her, and she survived, unlike the other ghosts from his past. So for him, there's another theme here. He got some redemption. Mm-hmm. But so too did Furiosa. So let's talk about her redemption.
Yeah, it's interesting because you never really find out sort of specifically what she's looking to be redeemed of, you know? I mean, you get hints, and the fact that she's Imperator for Immortan Joe means that she's probably done some pretty shitty stuff in his name. So, you know, you can imagine that that's sort of what may be going on there. And we don't see what, you know, what's the reason that she may did, you know, why now? Why is now a good time to go with the women? But regardless of exactly what prompted it, she's still out there trying to make a difference. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, she's taken these women and she is trying to improve their lives for no other reason than she can.
Mm-hmm. And it makes you wonder, too, how long she'd been planning that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the thing about, and I told you this as we were discussing it prior to recording, I said one of the cool-ass things about this movie is that it is just a giant bucket of show, not tell.
Yes.
It's absolutely, it's gorgeous writing. The way that the story narratives are woven together, and you get like a little heads up maybe in one scene, and then like 30 minutes later, that little heads up becomes something that you're like, oh, had I not seen that 30 minutes ago, this would have made no sense. Mm-hmm. So they're like breadcrumbs through the movie for each character that
yes
is important. And I freaking loved that. I love writing that is tight like that. Let's talk about pacing.
Oh God, the pacing. I mean, this movie is, well, it's a masterclass in action reaction, right? You know, I mean, that's one of the things that I was taught about writing is that you have your action and then you have to have space for the characters to react to it. And sometimes it's happening while the action is going on, and sometimes it's happening in a little bit of downtime. But it allows you to ramp things up and then like take the gas off a little bit, take a bit of a breather, and then ramp it up even higher. And this movie just keeps doing that. It like ramps it up, and then we get a bit of a pause and a bit of a breath, and then ramps it up again. And by the time you hit the climax, it's like, holy crap, how did we get here? And how is my heart not exploding?
Right. And so, friends, if you're going to see this movie, do not. And if you're seeing it in a theater, do not drink anything ahead of time, because
you can't miss anything.
There's no place for you to like get up and go to the bathroom. Seriously, you will miss. You can't do that. So, yeah, just a heads up. The first time I saw it, I made that mistake and I sat there and my bladder was exploding almost by the end. But I immediately went and saw it again the next day because it's that freaking good. Lise, you were talking about something interesting in terms of the cinematography and the colors and how those contribute to pacing and mood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the movie is sort of predominantly these like bright orange and brown and black tones. But we have portions of the movie, you know, there are night scenes that are shot in blue. And for a lot of those sort of evening scenes, it's more downtime. There isn't as much going on. And then we have these like, you know, bright red, like really sort of vibrant and visually chaotic scenes mm-hmm. where like all mm-hmm. the action is happening. And then there's that one scene where they're driving through and it's kind of like purples and blacks and it's eerie, and they drive through that one area where they have like the crows and the people on the stilts, and there's no dialogue, but you get this sense, because it's so different from everything else in the film, that something heavy is happening and we don't know what it is, and we don't find out for like another 20 minutes when that gets pulled back in. Mm-hmm. But it allows us to like go right back to that place and be like, oh, that's what that was.
Yeah, it's those breadcrumbs throughout. Mm-hmm. I was thinking here about Tom Hardy's character, Max, and Furiosa. And, you know, they actually don't have a lot of dialogue.
No, they don't. They don't say much at all.
They don't say much to each other at all. But the way they can, because they're, I mean, first off, there's so much shit going on that, you know, they're having to deal with all this stuff, but they had such a good rapport that there was so much said in their expressions mm-hmm. that they didn't need dialogue. And I think that was one of the real beauties of this film, was that people didn't talk a whole lot, but conveyed so much.
Right. Well, you know, they don't talk a whole lot. Who's the one who does all the talking? It's Immortan Joe.
It's Immortan Joe. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Yeah, he's the one who has to talk people over to do what he wants them to do.
Mm-hmm.
In stark contrast with, you know, with the other two who just kind of do what needs to be done. They're not shining anyone on. And he totally is. I mean, he's created this whole sort of mythology around himself and around this idea of Valhalla, so that the war boys and the people who serve him think that by sacrificing themselves for him, something better awaits. And it's probably not a hard sell in that environment. I mean, we're talking wasteland. So, you know, the idea that something better is out there is probably not difficult. Well, that something better is not here is not a difficult thing to sell.
Right.
But he's the one who does all the talking. He's constantly talking.
Yeah, blah, and, blah, blah.
And those two just do. I love that scene where they're on the war rig and there's that one vehicle that's bearing down on them and this guy is just like shooting the whole place up. And Max is trying to like pick him off with a sniper rifle.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that they have 4 shots left. And he takes 3, and someone's like, you have 1 shot left. And Furiosa comes up behind him. And she doesn't say anything. She just comes up behind him. And he, like, He kind of sighs, and then he hands the rifle back to her. Mm-hmm. And then the only thing she says to him is don't breathe, because now she's using him as a bipod, and together they like just take that shot. And the only two words that are said are don't breathe.
And that was such a great moment because it really conveyed the kind of rapport that these two characters had built up in a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I would call it trust as much as just sort of like a strange comradeship. And just it was a deeper bond than any sort of romantic connection. And you can't really describe that kind of bond because it was just like, you just can't. It was actually, I think, one of the coolest things about this film was watching the rapport between them and how Max and Furiosa interacted, and how Max was just like, they were on equal footing with each other. Mm-hmm. You know, they listened to each other. They sort of like went with each other's plans and then would talk about it. It was a really great way to convey information about, you know, what the next plan was, but also to see how they had come to this place through these experiences that they actually kind of really did believe in each other to some extent. I don't know if Max is capable of caring about anybody, but as much as he can, as he could as a character, you saw that reflected, I think, in that scene where Furiosa is wounded.
Yes.
And, you know, all throughout this movie, Max has never told them his name. Mm-hmm. They don't know what his name is. They just like go about their business and do their thing. And there's a scene where Furiosa is grievously wounded, and Max is trying to help her, and he tells her his name. And that scene, Jesus, Lee's, every time I see that scene, I cry, because it was so moving that he didn't say like, "Hey, you're the best, and you're gonna be okay." He didn't say anything like that. He just said, "Max, my name is Max." Mm-hmm. After he like was helping her, and they're driving back to the Citadel, and it was just like that depth of, for him, that was like a serious depth of emotion to tell her his name. And I just watched this movie tonight, and I was freaking bawling like a baby through that scene. I mean, it's a post-apocalyptic fuck clusterfuck, and here I am. Like, what the hell?
Mm-hmm. I love that there's no like chest thumping between them. They don't have to prove anything to each other, you know, beyond the fact that each one is competent in what they can do, and they demonstrate that in the course of what they're trying to do. And there's no need to like, there are no pissing contests. There are no, there's none of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just really refreshing to see a film with, you know, a male and a female lead with that kind of relationship between them. Mm-hmm. That doesn't also turn romantic.
Oh God, that was the best part. I talk a bit about the five women that are with Furiosa and their role in this film.
Yeah. So when we first meet them, they're basically just women who have been rescued, and they don't, you know, we don't know much about them. They're scared. They're freaked out. They're so out of their depth. And I really enjoyed watching each of them sort of come into her own throughout the film. And you get bits and pieces of personality that come through pretty quickly. And each of them has like these small sort of pivotal roles that come up throughout the film. And it's amazing to watch them get to make a difference and get to have some agency in their own rescue. You know, I mean, we were talking about feminist themes at the very beginning, and this is definitely one of them. I mean, yes, at the beginning, they need to be rescued, but every step along the way where they can, they are helping out and they are pulling their weight.
Mm-hmm.
These are not, you know, window dressing women who are just there to make the leads look good. They're they're doing stuff. There's one scene where Immortan Joe is about to shoot Furiosa, and one of the women just like throws open the door of the war rig and just like sticks her body in between Joe and Furiosa, because she knows he is not going to take that shot, and she just stares him down.
Plus, she was pregnant with his child. Mm-hmm. I mean, she literally put her body between that bullet and Furiosa. That was a really powerful scene.
Mm-hmm. And she just completely neutralizes him.
Mm-hmm. She did. It was amazing. It was such a great scene.
And then there's another scene where one of the women is freaking out at the beginning after, like, you know, the first time that the war rig stops. And she, like, is, like, freaking out and is, like, you know, screw this, I'm gonna go back. And they grab her and are, like, no, you know, this will be fine, this will, you know, we'll figure this out. And then, you know, there's another one of those breadcrumbs, right? Because later on in the movie, you see her, like, going back to the other side. And when I saw that, my heart sank. And I was, like, no, I thought we had dealt with this.
I know, right?
And then it turns out that, no, she's just fucking with them. And then she like turns around and helps Furiosa onto the other truck so that they can like take it out.
But that's what I mean about really good writing. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a writer who says, you know, if you introduce the murder weapon, like if you put the revolver on the mantle in the first chapter, you better fucking use it later on, right?
Yes.
You
know, like, Chekhov's gun.
There you go. That's what it was. And well, that's what they did here. And that the writing is so tight. And then the film editing, obviously, there had to be mm-hmm. a shit ton of editing, you know, for this film. But basically, damn, Lise, we've been talking about this film for a half hour. So I want to point out to people, too, that Fury Road, it's considered one of the greatest action films of all time and one of the greatest films of the 21st century. It's been widely praised for direction, screenplay, action sequences, the score is phenomenal, cinematography and ensemble cast. It's won shit tons of awards. It received 10 Academy Award nominations, including Best Picture and Best Director. It won 6. Costume design, production design, makeup and hairstyling, film editing, and sound mixing. So this is not some douchey post-apocalyptic film, friends. This is some serious filmmaking, and the results are freaking gorgeous. It's not just one of my favorite films because yay feminism, but because of the way it's put together and how those themes are handled, right, Lise?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it has the feminist rep for days. Place where it really falls short is that there are pretty much no people of color in this movie whatsoever.
Which was so fucking weird. Like, what is this? Really a white apocalypse? I mean, mm-hmm. It wiped out people of color and not white people? What is that?
Oh, see, I have a theory. I have a theory that like, all the people of color were like, you know, we're tired of your bullshit. We're just going to stick you in the middle of this desert. You guys have fun. We're going to go and live the high life.
I hope that's it, because the film did get dragged for that. And rightfully so.
It should have.
Mm-hmm. It totally should have. So, that was one of the weird things about this film, was like no overt people of color. I mean, maybe some were in those costumes, but you couldn't tell. I mean, and not to suggest that people of color, you know, that themes of racism and the like would have been explored, because in this world, everybody is shit and gets mm-hmm. lorded over. So, but it would have been great to see more people of color just in the representations, you know?
Right.
So that was kind of weird, but so be aware of that, friends. But the feminism was amazing and unexpected, actually. which made it that much better. But it is a visually stunning film. If you are not the kind of person who likes nonstop action and sort of violent action in those car chase scenes, mm-hmm. probably not the film for you. But I would suggest giving it a try just so you can get a sense of what a really great story looks like put to film.
Yeah. Oh, and that, I mean, watching that movie, I need to get back to my Furiosa cosplay.
Yeah, right? Any final thoughts on Fury Road, Lise, besides fucking rocks?
Oh, it fucking rocks so hard. I think we've hit the high points. Unless we want to sit here for another 30 minutes and really pull it apart, we should probably leave it there.
Which we totally could do.
But oh, we totally could.
Anyway. Okay, Lise, now comes the what have you been watching, reading, doing? Oh, fangirling over the last week or so.
I have been geeking out over the Netflix animated series The Dragon Prince. And since we were talking about it, I just discovered that season 2 came out 2 days ago. So I'm very excited. It's an animated show, which looks like it was probably put together for, like, you know, tweens and teens. And it's set, it's a fantasy type universe, hence dragon. And it's set with these two princes who accidentally discover this dragon egg that everyone thought had been killed or had been destroyed. And they team up with one of the assassins who was sent to take them and their father out, to take this dragon egg back to where it came from, to hopefully put an end to the war between sort of the elves and the magical kingdoms and the humans and their sort of dark magic, which is anathema to, like, everything that the elves and the magical kingdom stand for. It's really neat. There's a whole ton of really great world building. The characters are really interesting. There are some bad guys who are, yes, they're bad, but they're not two-dimensionally so. You know, we get some more stuff with them. It's just all in all, it's really well done, and I highly recommend it.
That sounds so cool. I'm good. Because I've been wondering about that, and now I'm like, oh, yeah, definitely. That one's on my list. I went to see, this past week, Alita Battle Angel.
Have
you seen the previews for this one?
No.
It's been, you know, there's been a lot of buzz around it. This is another one of those that got caught up in development hell. It was originally announced in 2003.
Oh, wow.
James Cameron is the director, and it's a cyberpunk action film based on Yukito Kishiro's manga series Gundam. I think that's how you pronounce it. Also known as Battle Angel Alita. So what this is basically is that Alita is she's a cyborg, and she's found in a scrapyard. I mean, the setup, the visuals are astonishing. You've got, like, Iron City, which is like the shitty divey city, and then above it, you've got Zalem, the beautiful sky city, you know, where all the rich, you know, groovy people live. And they drop all their scrap down onto Iron City. And so Dr. Dyson Ito, a scientist, finds Alita there in the scrap pile, as, like, she's got, like, her face, her head, and part of her torso, and that's it. And he just happens to be a renowned scientist and a cybernetics dude, and so he literally puts her back together and builds her a body. And then we come to find out that she's actually, like, 3 centuries old and left over from the battles of the fall. So she's a battle angel. She is literally a battle cyborg.
Oh, wow.
And so the whole setup is that, you know, who's doing all this creepy shit from Zalem? And there's, like, this evil force, this evil dude up there, of course. And then there's the Iron City. And how do you keep the masses happy and not revolting? Well, you give them a brutal, bloody sport. In this case, it's motorball, which is sort of like roller derby with blades.
Oh, shit.
And weaponry and cyborg people and, like, a ball. There's a ball that's involved. So visually, like I said, it's absolutely astonishing. I mean, the graphics of this film are really, really beautiful. The screenplay, I felt, was kind of muddled up. And, like, there were parts I was like, what the fuck? It felt like it was stitched together way too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Alita is portrayed by Rosa Salazar. And you know how they did this movie? They basically put you in those, like, cyber suits. So when they film you, they film, like, your facial motions and stuff, and then graft it onto the CGI. But there's still actual actors portraying these people. And, I mean, I loved her as Alita. And Alita, turns out, she has kind of a soft heart about the reasons that she does things. And she ends up falling in love with a human. And there's, like, this kind of subtext there, this, you know, another narrative. But like I said, there were parts of it that I was just like, wow, this is so great. And then there were other parts that I was like, that makes absolutely no sense. What the hell? So it's set up. They set it up for a sequel. I don't know what's going to happen. I'll go see it because I'm fascinated with this character. And now, actually, I would like to read the manga, to check out the manga. And I'm hoping I can do that in English because, unfortunately, I do not speak or read Japanese. But anyway, because I want to know where this came from, because it was really kind of a feast for the eyes, and the story is really interesting. So that's what I did. Yeah,
it sounds really cool.
That's it for my fangirling for the week. What about, you got anything else, Liz?
Well, I have to let Wheatley out, so.
Friends, that's Liz's cat. He's kind of the mascot of Les Geek Out. All right.
Yes.
Just a quick reminder, friends. Flexicon is coming up the first week of April, and Liz and I will be there. La, la, la. It's in Las Vegas. So if you are going to be there, please come and find us. That would be so awesome. Great to check, to just chit-chat and give us ideas, you know. You can find us on LGO Podcast on Twitter and at our website, lesgeekoutcast.com. And if you want us to cover something or talk about something, or, you know, something you'd like to discuss in terms of fangirling, we'd love to have you on, right, Liz?
Absolutely.
Sure. We'll have other folks on to talk with us. This stuff is fun. So just drop us a line. Let us know what you think and what you'd like to do. And you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, all the places. Like, subscribe, and that way other folks can find us on the interwebs, and we'd like to be found. That's it, friends. Thanks for hanging out with us. Fury Road is awesome. And we will catch you next time. Peace. What is Wheatley doing?
I don't know. I kicked him out. Ah! He's just like, he jumped down off the desk and then was like, I'm just going to sit here next to the door and clean myself. And I'm like, yeah, you're 2 seconds away from pounding on it. Out you go.
You know him so well.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised he sat quietly for most of the cast. So
yeah, he did. Normally he's like in the middle of it. Ah, I'm done. Ah, mm-hmm. Ah, so
yes, and he definitely has a voice for he has a voice for silent film. Let's put it that way.
Oh, Wheatley, thank you. All right, I'm gonna shut this down.
Yeah.